Christina Lake Cannabis is using proprietary outdoor genetics to grow and harvest cannabis in Western Canada. And with a 99-acre expansion, production should increase from nearly 72,000 pounds to a harvest capacity of over 194,000 pounds of high-quality, refined cannabis to extract exceptional THC and CBD oils. This cannabis highlight has been brought to you by Christina Lake Cannabis, U.S. trading symbol CLCFF and the Canada CLC. ChristinaLakeCannabis.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a great pleasure to welcome my colleague of many years, Terry Anderson, of the Hoover Institution. But now this is the author, Terry Anderson, and the editor, Terry Anderson. The new book is Adapt and Be Adept. This is a story of market responses to climate change all around us. The chapters here go in many different directions about politics, about economics, about the physics of energy, and also one lovely chapter about an Alaska Native villages, one in particular on the Koyukuk River, which is a tributary of the Yukon River, where adaption is automatic, and yet people must have control, authority. They must have input for their adaption. It can't be imposed from outside. Terry, a very good evening to you, and it's a pleasure to speak about a subject that's all around us. You have a witticism in here that I'm going to call up right now about climate change. It's Pascal's wager. Pascal's wager had to do with, in the original, with suppose there's a God, suppose there's not a God. What are your choices? And as I recall, the way the wager goes, I'm going to believe in God because if I do, there'll be heaven and eternity. If I don't, I'll give up some candy and I'll not be a rascal on good days. But that's not losing a whole lot given what I'll gain if there is a God. Now, if I apply that to climate change, suppose there's climate change and suppose there's not. Why not proceed as if there is? Because then, of course, I will be prepared for the changes that are coming. Have I stated Pascal's wager correctly in the analogy? Good evening to you, Terry.
And good evening to you, John. I think you've stated it very well. And in fact, just what you said, if climate change is real, we can tilt at windmills, no pun intended. Well, maybe it was a pun intended. Or we can be prepared in other ways, as the people, the Alaska Natives on the river you mentioned, are prepared if they have the ability to adapt, the wherewithal to adapt, and the information at hand to encourage them to adapt. And those people who live in Alaska on that river have the reality of the day, and it is what encourages them to adapt. And if climate change affects their lives, they will know it, and they will adapt because they want to survive.
You have different chapters by economists and all very well constructed, and they go in different directions. I want to seize upon the chapter by Mark Mills, Hydrocarbons Are Here to Stay. There are some statistics, but I want to look at a chart that you provide for us. Acquiring fuel and food as a share of GDP. It begins in the beginning of the 14th century, 1300, and extends to 2000. We're well into the 21st century. And my goodness, Terry, we were dominated by wood and the search for food for 900 of those years. It's only recently that it's been possible to generate electricity thanks to fossil fuels so that we could specialize and prosper. Terry, when you look at this chart, you think to yourself, no way we're going back. No way. We're going to have to figure out how to maintain our electric load, our specialty, and at the same time deal with climate change. Is that a general opinion, or is there still a debate out there, Terry, whether we're going to go backwards or not?
Oh, I think there's still debate, and there are many people who would like to see us, I don't know whether they would call us going backward, but would like to see us move away from those fossil fuels, not towards wood, of course, but towards alternative energy in the form of solar and wind. And I think that's a going backwards of sort. I think they see it as the move forward, the people who support that change.
Now, Mark Mills has some statistics here that are hard to overcome. One is that the electric generation from renewables on planet Earth right now is 2%. In the U.S. is 3%. We do a little better than planet Earth. However, there are physical limits to what we understand renewables can do. I'm chiefly speaking of solar and wind, but I'll bring in hydroelectric and I'll bring in nuclear as well as a broad definition of renewables. At the same time, the cost of generating the electricity we need, the cost of generating the energy we need is daunting. I mean, I don't think we have enough money to match what fossil fuels can do for us. Is that an accepted generality? We can't afford to be renewable yet.
Well, you use the term, do we have enough money? And therein is the solution as seen by Washington bureaucrats and politicians for how we can afford it. We will simply print and dump money into the proposals that are moving forward in Washington towards these renewables that are far more costly than the market can bear. And so, you know, we will use government debt. We will use inflationary tactics to pay for this. But if you say, can we afford it in any kind of meaningful economic calculus, the answer is emphatically no. And I think another point to emphasize out of Mark Mills' chapter, is that we have had huge efficiency gains in these renewables, especially wind and solar. But like any productive capacity, these efficiency gains come early on because anybody can figure out how to put a new bearing into this windmill or make that solar panel just a little bit more productive. But once you've exhausted those early gains, the percentage increases are very minimal. And the result then is we can't come close to matching the energy demands that we have that are now met by fossil fuels.
Costs. I'm writing down some numbers here that were awfully persuasive. $1 million worth of shale gas, that is the natural gas, produces 300 million kilowatts of power. $1 million worth of renewables produces 50 kilowatt hours of power. Terry, game over.
Exactly. The orders of magnitude there are just startling. And when you look at the zeros in those two numbers you just wrote on your paper, you just say, how can we possibly imagine that renewables are going to displace gas from shale? And then to emphasize the importance of the cleanliness of gas and really the cleanliness of all fossil fuels compared to the past and in the case of natural gas, just pure and simple, it is a clean source of energy, though it's fossil fuel based.
The other part about renewables is that the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine, so you need storage, and that means batteries. Now, quite distinct here, I write down again, $1 stores a barrel of oil or an equivalent amount of natural gas, $1, to store the same amount of energy for a battery, it costs you $200. So now, Terry, it is possible that people want to overpay that much because they're virtuous. It is possible. But this seems fantastic at this point. Is there reason to believe that $200 for the battery can improve? Or are we topped out with battery storage?
Well, again, back to the efficiency point, I don't think we're topped out, but to improve it to the point of getting it from 200 to 1, we are not going to have that happen. And then there's another constraint, and that is the availability of lithium. Of course, lithium requires, heaven forbid, mining. And mining is another no-no for the environmental community that is afraid of global warming. Now, if you stop mining for lithium, then you don't have the lithium for batteries. And without lithium, that storage that now costs $200 won't be $200 anymore. It'll be $400.
I'm speaking with Terry Anderson of the Hoover Institution, but he is also the editor of a new book, Adapt and Be Adept, Market Responses to Climate Change. We're going to speak of the recommendations and the suggestions of adaptation, but first we're going to go to Alaska, to the Alaskan Native villages in the United States of America, and lessons learned from managing or not being permitted to manage your adaptation to climate change. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. And Terry Anderson is here of the Hoover Institution, the editor Terry Anderson, an author. His new edited book is Adapt and Be Adept, Market Responses to Climate Change. Without the market, you have people who live very carefully on the land. They're subsistence. There's an elaborate definition of subsistence, but in any event, what it means is that you deal with your environment effectively. You keep heat and food and your children prosper. There is an Alaska Native village chain throughout Alaska, the United States, called ANV in this book, a very excellent piece by a anthropologist who spent time with the Alaska Native villages. And what I learn is that there are a series of laws that have been passed since 1971 and 1981 in the late 20th century that have not permitted or inadvertently left out participation by the people who live near the wildlife and the sustainability of the Alaska Native villages. And the lesson I take from this, Terry, and I'm submitting it to you, the editor, lesson I take this, unless the consumers or the villagers or the people who live on the land and live inside the adaptation, unless they participate, none of your solutions are going to work. Is that the lesson you wanted me to learn from this chapter?
Very much. They have known how to adapt for eons, and because of all the things you just described, have no ability to really adapt. They can't follow the caribou herds. They can't move along the rivers to different fishing zones. And that inability to adapt is just a major part of what it stands in the way of adaptation to climate change. Let me back even further up to Native Americans in the continental United, or what is now the continental United States. They didn't just survive on the Great Plains. They thrived, and they thrived by adapting. They thrived by following bison herds. As one of my Native American friends in northern Montana said, people think we just stumbled upon berry patches. No, we knew where they were, and we cared for them. They adapted in that way. And I think we've lost sight of the human ingenuity, the hope that we should have as human beings, given our long history of human ingenuity, to adapt to all variety of things, COVID most recently, I suppose. But adaptation to climate change then is a true hope for how we can live with and indeed prosper from climate change.
I begin the conversation about Kenneth Costello's chapter on what are our choices, political choices, in climate change and adaptation. As I understand it, Terry, and correct me because I'm making notes very quickly on this complicated story, we have three possible responses. A collective response, that would be that we all live in heaven and we agree with each other. An incentivized response, that would be, say, a climate club or carbon tax, either shame or legislate or force people into certain conduct. And a market's response. So let us speak of the, not collective, we're not in heaven yet. Mark Twain is, but we're not. All right, let us speak of the incentivized choices. Does that describe something utopian called the climate club? Does that describe carbon tax? And why or why not will those work for us?
Yes, it does describe a carbon tax, and the chapter by Ken is a good description of why the blackboard economics, as he points out, which is the derivation of the carbon tax. It's the idea that economists can draw some graphs on the blackboard and show you that if we shift the curves around this way and that way, we can achieve socially optimal results. What Blackboard Economics forgets is that if you look out the window into Washington, D.C., it is not economists striving to find the optimal carbon tax that will generate this socially bliss point, the social bliss point, but rather it's politics that determines what that tax is. And when the tax, if a carbon tax gets imposed, it will be differential. It will be based entirely on who's at the table, or as I once was in a conference with the Wall Street Journal and in a discussion there, as Jeff Immelt, the former CEO of General Electric, put it, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And if you're at the table when they determine the optimal carbon tax in Washington, you're going to say, don't tax me, tax them. And that taxation will certainly have incentive effects, but it won't be socially optimal.
It will not be socially optimal because there's some arbitrary numbers here that cannot be fixed. The social costs of carbon is one of them. The pollution tax, taxes in general. But what I learned from Ken Costello is that this whole story comes to a halt when there are polarized views. Did I read that correctly? That polarization is what must be avoided.
Yeah, I mean, the polarized views are what arise again in the political discussions. Don't tax me, tax you, that's what creates the polarization in the first place. It's politics that creates the polarization. And the option then is to seek ways that are not polarizing, but rather are harmonizing. And markets do that. And really, this book is about how do we as human beings harmonize with one another and with the climate change that we are facing.
All right. So we should avoid rhetorical heat. We should avoid polarization. Boy, does this not sound like Washington, Terry. Okay, fine. But we're going to do all that. And the reason we're going to do all that is because the politicians are not in charge. If I see this, Mr. Costello is making the case that the consumers are in charge. That would be the same as those Alaska Native villages. They're in charge of managing that river, not the bosses in the capitals.
In the market, it's the consumer who ultimately is in charge. Many people may think that we're all governed by these evil corporations, but we as consumers are in charge, and we will adapt if faced with the reality of climate change. And it's happening. I mean, it's happening as farmers begin to move crop production farther north because it doesn't freeze as early and as late as it used to. Here in Montana, wheat crops are beginning to be grown in places they weren't grown before. And that's again a response by people who are consuming the environment, if you will, consuming the weather to produce the wheat that we all want in our bread.
I'm glad you mentioned Montana, Terry, because at one point you were entertaining the vineyards of Montana. Now, that seems a bridge too far right now, given the weather of April and September where it snows. But it's not impossible that you could have vineyards there in some of the valleys. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And again, if you actually look at grape production in Europe, the really good grape production in France is slowly migrating to the north and to the east, and it's going to happen in the United States. Look at the Columbia Valley in Washington. It was never known for its grape production 50 years ago. Today, it's a major producer of fine wines.
Let's go to the question of trade and climate policy when we come back. Adapt and be adept. Terry Anderson is the editor. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. My colleague, Terry Anderson of the Hoover Institution, is the editor of a new book, Adapt and Be Adept. This is Market Responses to Climate Change. And one of the market responses is trade. Again, we're looking at the question of not what if there's climate change. We're assuming Pascal's wager, we're going to assume there is climate change because we'll adapt beforehand. If there's not, we haven't heard anything. We've made some adjustments, and it was probably all to the better that we were in charge. It empowered us. But I'm assuming there is climate change, and it's time to adapt. Trade is one way, and one of the pieces that Terry edits and publishes by Timothy Fitzgerald is about trade and climate policy. And there's a term of art here I'm learning. This has to do with border carbon adjustments. What is that, Terry?
Well, first off, Tim is a longtime friend, former colleague, and he spent time in the Trump administration with the Council of Economic Advisors, and I think he received a real education in whether economics or politics dominates, and you can guess which does. And the notion of these border maneuvers to try and account for climate change is that we will correct the price that we pay for goods by forcing other countries to put taxes on their products to change the price to reflect, again, the carbon they use. That's how the theory goes. But in fact, what happens is people who want trade barriers use this disguise, or they put the wolf in sheep's clothing in this being climate change, and they disguise then the real goal of many of these policies, which is to impose tariffs or obtain subsidies that are beneficial to the people who want those subsidies and tariffs, and they're the ones in Washington. Again, they're at the table.
So what we're looking at here is is this a disguised form of protectionism? Is that what this is? How I should read this?
Totally. That is exactly what it is. And so you can disguise it quite nicely because you say, oh, it's climate change and we have to worry about this. And, oh, by the way, underneath here is protection for my industry. Pure and simple, it is just that. It is protectionism. Another way to think about it is a theory in economics called the bootleggers and Baptist theory. And the theory goes this way. Why do we have liquor laws in the South that prevent the sale of liquor on Sundays? And the answer is, well, Baptists don't want you imbibing on the Sabbath. Of course, the bootleggers are happy to have the limits because they then get to sell their booze on Sunday through illegal markets. The same is true of climate change. The Baptists are the environmentalists who say, oh, we have to equalize the price of these goods at borders to reflect carbon that's being produced elsewhere. And the bootleggers are the people who say, we agree with you. We do need tariffs, but we want them on this product or that product. And again, it becomes just what you said, protectionism.
So this is emissions trading system, regional greenhouse gas initiative, carbon club. Those are all clever ways of presenting the same story. This is going to be top down, incentivized with taxes or tariffs or in some fashion a protectionism. That's what those all refer to.
Sure. Take the emission trading system that everybody thought would be the global solution started in Europe. And the idea was you would allow some emissions, you would give credits to people to trade these emissions, and they would find more efficient ways to produce electricity or energy generally with less carbon. But very quickly, people who started to produce wind energy said, well, we didn't get any credits, and we're really the saviors of the world, so give us some credits. And it's just like pouring new money into the economy. It destroyed that market that was beginning to grow as we increased the number of credits out there, and the price declined, and then the incentive to innovate went away.
All right, we've eliminated that we're all in heaven with Mark Twain. We've said that incentivizing isn't going to work because you'll probably wind up being on the menu and not at the table. So what's the payoff? We come to improving price discovery to accelerate adaptation to climate change. In other words, the marketplace. This is an article that Terry edits in the new book, Gregory Charaklis, Benjamin Foster, and Matthew Kahn. The price discovery is a term of art that economists use very well. What does it mean when in terms of climate change? Who's in charge of discovering the price, and what does it mean once we find it, Terry?
Well, no one is in charge of, if by that we mean that some agency in Washington will determine those prices. But price determination in the marketplace and in the chapter discussed here, price determination comes from financial markets and risk markets, where people are continually trying to find changes in risk that are changing the actual values and therefore the prices. So people look out and say, "Wow, there's a growing risk of storm surge on the Miami coast. How would this be reflected?" And what they find is that, gee, maybe we should sell some of our real estate along the coast and buy some along the higher levels. And so what happens then? The price of the coastal lands goes down, and the price of the higher lands goes up. And that's just exactly what the data show. So this is a form of price discovery that the normal consumer doesn't think about, but it's what drives the decimal points that make people rich on Wall Street.
Right. Well, we're looking at, and I read carefully here, putting property rights together with risk allocation. And I think that we already do this. I think we already have a model. Isn't that what flood insurance is about? Isn't that what fire insurance is about? Taking risk and putting it together with private property and finding a price.
As long as the insurance prices, again, reflect what we know about those risks. I just read another article pointing out that we subsidize flood insurance. Well, if you subsidize flood insurance and you're worried about flooding being greater because of global warming, guess what you get? More building than you'd want in areas that are flood prone. The chapter in the book that I just love is a chapter by Ron Bailey on fire insurance in California. The California Insurance Commission will not allow insurance companies to drop or change the rates of people based on those properties being in wildfire zones. Well, if you don't do that, then people have no incentive to really move out of the path of wildfires. And there again, you're giving the wrong price information. And when we have the wrong prices, people respond in ways that aren't consistent with adaptation to climate change.
There's a subplot here, Terry, that when governments, local or national, get involved, you cannot discover the price, and trouble's going to come down the road. Now, what I learned from this chapter on price discovery is that we need more and better information about climate change. More and better information. That discourages these long-term projections, I believe, the statistical projections. That encourages people to react to what they actually see in front of them. Is that correct, or are statistics useful in finding risk?
Well, it depends on how good the models are that make the predictions. But let me first back up to the actual statistics. As the authors point out, there's an extremely important role for government to play in gathering the data on rainfall, on temperature, on humidity, all the kinds of variables that we'd want to take into account if we were going to sense climate change. And the government production of those kind of or collection of those kind of data and dissemination of those kinds of data, making those data transparent, is a crucial part of price discovery. Then the people who are determining insurance prices that we just talked about, or are creating new financial instruments to account for risk, have information that they can use to adjust. Then there's the question of what predictions should we make? And we economists have a term, we say garbage in, garbage out. And if you have bad models for making these predictions, which is what the climate change models were in the early days, they've gotten better, but they're still not very good. I've been dealing with some flood issues here in Montana, and the ability of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, to really accurately predict flooding is horrible, because they have garbage in and they get garbage out from those models. So predictions depend on good models, and financial markets that are successful require good models. And there, I think the financial people are better able to take the data that the government should and is collecting and put it into models that they use to make their predictions.
Right now, Terry, is there such a thing as a credit market, Moody's and Standard & Poor's mentioned in your book, that can price drought, price floods, price fires? Can they do that if the state doesn't get involved? Can they give a good price that people trust?
Oh, I think absolutely. But if you then said, well, what's the evidence? It's hard to find, because so many of these markets are distorted by government insurance programs. So take the crop insurance program in agriculure, a program that subsidizes people to make bad decisions, essentially. Go ahead and plant your crop out there, and you didn't take account of the fact that the price, that temperatures were going to be too high due to climate change. Well, we will now give you an insurance policy that's subsidized and pay you because your crop failed. If we do that over and over, then there is no way that markets are going to respond in any effective way, if we mean really adapting to climate change. And so it's hard to find markets that don't have this sort of distortion built into them due to, again, politics.
The book is Adapt and Be Adept. Terry Anderson is the editor. Market Responses to Climate Change. When we come back, we're going to discuss not just discovering the right price, but also, is it okay to, in some fashion, defend yourself? Does that adapt to the future correctly? I'm thinking of a seawall. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network, and I'm speaking with great pleasure with Terry Anderson, my colleague. He's the Hoover Institution, but he's the editor of a new book, Adapt and Be Adept, Market Responses to Climate Change. Assume climate change. What is to be done? We've been discussing how carbon taxes incentivized from the top, or carbon clubs incentivized from the top, are not going to work very effectively. They're going to be imposed, and therefore there will be either resistance or indifference, or they'll fail because the prices are not honestly discovered. They're obliged. Then again, the question of when you find the price, when the consumers adapt to what is going on around them locally, regionally, nationally. Can they do more than that? And I learned from a chapter that Terry publishes by Bjorn Lomborg, the very well-known commentator, I read him all the time in the Wall Street Journal op-ed page, about climate change, about the changes that the Earth is undergoing. And I learned from him that for a long time, adaptation was, I think the way he put it, Terry, was bad form. I don't understand that. Was it unaccepted because you were seen as denying climate change? Is that why?
Well, exactly. And in fact, Bjorn has been continually accused of being a climate denier. And you don't need to read more than a couple of sentences of anything he's written recently to find that he's no longer. I think there was a time, along with many others, that people were skeptical of just the extent to which climate was changing. And Bjorn was one of them, as was I. Now the data suggests it is changing. And Bjorn then has said, well, what are, if we're going to spend trillions of dollars, it used to be we could say billions, and it was a big number, but now we have to use
yeah,
trillions.
It's the going thing, trillions. Terry, trillion. Everybody says it now.
It is. Yeah. Who cares about a billion?
Right.
If you're going to spend trillions of dollars, what's the sensible way to do it? And Bjorn got together a group of Nobel laureates and created what was called, they were brought together in Copenhagen, the Copenhagen Consensus. And these Nobel laureates in economics sat down and said, well, what do we get if we spend a dollar on controlling malaria in terms of lives saved versus a dollar on more wind power to hopefully stop hurricanes? And the answers just are always unequivocal. Spend the money on sensible things like trying to slow malaria. That's how you save lives. Spend money on getting people in remote villages in Africa to be able to use propane so that they aren't burning dung in their houses without chimneys, breathing in the smoke and getting cancer. And Bjorn is just a pragmatist. He's a climate pragmatist in that he just says, let's look at sensible ways to deal with and adapt to climate change rather than try to stop it, which is what the climate environmentalists are calling for. We aren't going to stop climate change. It is here. It's going to be here. And we as human beings need to think of ways, which we've done from time immemorial, ways that we can adapt to it, move out of its way, utilize it to improve our productivity. And if we're going to spend money, which there's good case to be made for spending money, spend it sensibly.
You can build beaches. That helps. You can encourage mangroves. That helps on the coasts. You can build seawalls. And you have a lovely example about how price discovery is adapting to climate change. This is the price of beachfront property. Explain, please, Terry.
Well, the data, there was a Harvard study, a really very, very good statistical study of data in Dade County for real estate prices. And again, this isn't denying storm surge. It's more storm surge than the actual hurricanes themselves. But it's not denying that this is happening, but saying if there's greater storm surge, what would you expect to happen to properties that are located in the path of that surge? And the answer is you'd expect those properties to go down. And that's what this study finds. Those property values do go down. Well, people don't just necessarily leave Florida then and move to Montana. They move to higher places. And what would you expect to happen as they move to higher ground? The answer is then the prices go up. And we're not talking about going from sea level to 2,000 feet above sea level. We're talking about just going up a few feet. And you can do that in Dade County and in other places in Florida. And again, real estate markets are discovering the prices, and they're adjusting people's behavior accordingly.
I want to go back to Mark Mills's piece because there were statistics I didn't use. I was waiting to use them, but here they are. 60 pounds of a battery equals 1 pound of hydrocarbons. That tells you that batteries are not our future. No matter whether you can find and mine the lithium or not, they're not the future. There are actual physical limits of what renewable energy can do. So, Terry, I accept the fact that once there was doubt about climate change. There's increasingly no doubt about it. But there is doubt by those people who advocate renewable energy sources only. I believe the Biden administration has talked about all the electricity in the United States to be generated by renewables by the year, I think they picked 2035. Terry, they appear to be in denial of the physical limits of batteries and renewables. They appear that way. How do they appear to you?
They are totally in denial. There's just no way that we can produce the kind of energy that we need. We talked about this earlier, and Mark Mills makes this point so clear. The energy requirements that not that the we have, we are obviously a big economy, but the energy requirements of the world are so great that you can't do it with alternative energy. And then in addition to that, you have communities like my little town in Montana saying we're going to be carbon neutral by 2035. You can't live in a rural environment, a cold rural environment, and not burn fossil fuels. And so we can change the insulation in our city buildings, and we can reroute traffic in a hope of reducing the number of miles traveled. But in the end, we cannot become carbon neutral, and we certainly can't be totally dependent on alternative energy.
The book is Adapt and Be Adept. Terry Anderson is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.
Christina Lake Cannabis is using proprietary outdoor genetics to grow and harvest cannabis in Western Canada. And with a 99-acre expansion, production should increase from nearly 72,000 pounds to a harvest capacity of over 194,000 pounds of high-quality, refined cannabis to extract exceptional THC and CBD oils. This cannabis highlight has been brought to you by Christina Lake Cannabis, U.S. trading symbol CLCFF, and in Canada CLC. ChristinaLakeCannabis.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.